plus the first performance of a new carol by Jonathan Harvey. The run-up to Christmas begins. A service for Advent with carols, live from Cambridge, this afternoon from 4 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news read by David Cornett.
Business leaders have welcomed an announcement by the Chancellor, George Osborne, that the Treasury is to underwrite up to £40 billion in bank lending to small and medium-sized companies. The CBI said the scheme had the potential to make a real impact, but Labour said that without other growth measures, the plan would do little to persuade firms to invest. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has urged the government and the unions to compromise in the dispute about public sector pensions. There's expected to be widespread disruption when more than 2 million people take part in industrial action on Wednesday. The Arab League is meeting in Cairo to consider imposing new sanctions on Syria for failing to stop state violence being inflicted on political dissenters. The Arab foreign ministers are likely to approve a freeze on business dealings with Damascus and a ban on visits to Arab countries by senior Syrian officials. The Wales football manager, Gary Speed, has died at the age of 42. He's understood to have taken his own life. Gary Speed was appointed national team manager almost a year ago after a long and successful playing career. As a former captain of Wales, he won 85 caps, the most for a Welsh outfield player. A search operation is continuing for the Russian crew of a cargo ship which sank off the Welsh coast. 3 members have been recovered, 5 are still missing. Prince William was the co-pilot of a helicopter which rescued 2 survivors. NATO has acknowledged that its helicopters were responsible for the attack in which 25 Pakistani soldiers were killed early on Saturday. The organisation's Secretary-General, Anas Fogh Rasmussen, has written to the Pakistani Prime Minister offering his condolences for what he described as a tragic and unintentional incident. Iran's parliament has voted to downgrade diplomatic ties with the UK. Britain's ambassador could be expelled if the decision is approved by Iran's Guardian Council. And the weather, the strong winds will gradually ease, followed by plenty of sunshine for most areas. However, the far northwest will see blustery showers falling as snow on Scottish hills. BBC News and weather at 1:03.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, the second of this weekend's early music shows, introduced by Lucy Skeeping, after this opening music. Thank you.
violinist Christopher Field and harpsichordist John Kitchen with the Scottish tune Rory Dull's Port by James Oswald. And it's Oswald who's the focus of today's early music show. You may not know his name, but in the mid-18th century he was quite a force on the London musical scene. He owned his own publishing house and was the official chamber composer to George III. His story begins, though, a long way from the capital. Oswald was born in 1710 in the tiny coastal town of Crail in East Fife. His father was the town drummer, not so much a member of a band, Crail was far too small for that, but more a kind of town crier who literally drummed up attention in the bustling fish market, shouting out the news, both local and from further afield. So it wasn't exactly rock and roll, but with an annual salary reported of £10 and several pairs of shoes, the Oswalds managed reasonably well. Music must have played a big part in James's upbringing. He was raised on a diet of traditional melodies, and presumably fish, and soon began writing folk-style tunes himself, playing them on the fiddle and the cello. And at the age of 21, he left the family home and moved a few miles southwest to Dunfermline to earn his living as a music teacher and a dancing master.
Come, my fairest learn of me. Learn to give and take the bliss. Come, my love, here's none but we. I'll instruct thee how to kiss. Why turn from me that dear face? Why that blush and downcast eye? Come, meet my fond embrace, and the mutual rapture die, and the mutual rapture die. Throw thy lovely assume a French fantastic air. Oft when the generous Briton fails, the foppish foreigner prevails.
her to dance as the mode is in France, and make the best use of your feet. Cock your hat with a grace, all be brazen your face, and dress most affectedly neat. And dress most affectedly neat. Then bow down like a beau, hop and turn out your toe, lead Miss by the hand and leer at her. Throw your glove with an air at her white stocking stare, and simper and ogle and flatter, and simper and ogle and flatter. Walk the figure of eight with your rump stiff and straight, then turn her with delicate ease. Bow again very low, your good breeding to show, and Missy you'll perfectly please. And Missy you'll perfectly please. If these steps you pursue, you will soon bring her to, and rifle the child of her charms. Her poor heart will heave high, and she'll languish and sigh, and caper quite into your arms. And caper quite into your arms.
The tenor Ian Paton with Concerto Caledonia in those two songs by James Oswald. The Dancing Master, which pokes fun at the fancy footwork of foreign dance teachers. And before that, a song entitled The Tutor, where the Scottish dancing master takes his techniques of seduction more seriously. Mind you, Oswald himself took his own role as a dancing master in Dunfermline extremely seriously. He spent much of his time on the country house circuit, teaching wealthy families the latest steps and giving after-dinner recitals, songs and minuets in the Italian style, along with his own variations on his beloved Scots tunes. And we're told that he turned up at these grand front doors on his horse with his cello and violin strapped firmly on his back. But Oswald was ambitious, and at the age of 25, he now moved on to Edinburgh, where he continued to teach and compose. He also discovered that he had a natural talent as a publisher, and in fact a notebook of his was recently found, which shows the sort of things he was working on and that interested him. It contains copies of Italian pieces, along with his own arrangements of folk music. Clearly, Oswald was hoping to show his public that not only could he write music in the Scottish style, with a local flavour, but he could also hold his own alongside any of the great European masters. Nowadays, we view Oswald as Scotland's chief representative of the so-called gallant style, a clearer, simpler form, if you like, than the complexity of the old Baroque era, which put the emphasis more on melody than polyphony. But the old local tunes were never far from his thoughts, and his sonata on Scots tunes, which we're going to hear now, became extremely popular, the first of its kind to feature different traditional tunes as the basis for each movement. It's played here by Concerto Caledonia.
Thank you.
The Sonata on Scots Tunes by James Oswald, performed there by Concerto Caledonia. Oswald spent 6 years living and working in Edinburgh, but he knew that if he really wanted to advance his career, he had to move to the bright lights of London. And by 1741, we find him there in the capital, working for the music publisher Simpson and enjoying the support of his fellow Freemasons. It wasn't long before he opened his own publishing shop by St Martin in the Fields and began to make some serious money from his compositions. He had to adapt his writing style quickly to suit London tastes, but he soon found his feet and teamed up with the Scottish poet and dramatist Robert Dodsley. The two had probably met at the Scotch Holland Warehouse in Pall Mall, where Oswald was offering Londoners lessons in Scotch music, highly fashionable at the time. And since Dodsley had also risen from humble beginnings north of the border, the two soon found they had much in common. Together, they produced what was to become one of Oswald's most popular works, a collection of 12 songs under the appealingly folksy title Colin's Kisses. It's been called the first ever song cycle, a wonderfully sentimental collection with each song portraying a different kind of kiss. And there are quite a lot of variations, believe me. So a little early music show snogfest now, with 3 songs from Colin's Kisses, sung by Catherine Bott and Ian Paton with the musicians of Concerto Caledonia. The Borrowed Kiss, The Stolen Kiss, and to begin, The Secret Kiss.
At a silent evening hour, two fond lovers in a bar sought their mutual bliss, though her heart was just relenting. Repay it all and more.
Concerto Caledonia with Catherine Bott and Ian Paton in songs by James Oswald. Three of his song cycle, Collins Kisses, to words by Robert Dodsley. Oswald quickly became something of a name on the London music scene in the 1740s and 50s. It helped, of course, that he had a good business sense. In fact, his compositions were mostly market-driven. Scots, English, Italian and French styles and combinations of all of them were all fair game, whatever was demanded or might be saleable. He worked in the theatre, he worked in the pleasure gardens, he wrote chamber music, promoted concerts, set up his own publishing house and produced endless volumes of his Caledonian Pocket Companion, hugely in demand and packed full of more than 550 playable and accessible arrangements of traditional tunes, many of which were to inspire Robert Burns. Benjamin Franklin was also a fan, and he was a man with very specific musical tastes. When asked his views of a concert given by Handel, he once replied, "Too much repetition." But Oswald on his cello was evidently a different matter. "There were tears of pleasure in the eyes of the audience," Franklin noted, and we can assume he included himself in that. And then there was Charles Burney. "During my connection with Drury Lane Theatre," he wrote, "I became intimately acquainted with Oswald, the Scottish Orpheus, the celebrated performer of old Scots tunes on the violin, cello, and maker of many more, which by his manner of playing them and keeping a music shop on the pavement of St Martin's churchyard turned to good account." So we're beginning to see a picture of Oswald creating a unique musical world for himself, filling complementary roles as a composer, publisher and performer, and a professional Scotsman, if you like. Oddly, though, some of the pieces for which he's best remembered, he wrote for an instrument he didn't actually play himself, the English guitar. Not that it was much like the kind of guitar we know today. The 18th century so-called guitar was shaped just like the cittern of the 17th century, a round shape with no waist, quite light and strung with wire rather than gut. And Oswald was so fascinated by the instrument that he published no fewer than 5 books of pieces for it. Here's one of the 12 divertimenti he published in 1759. It's the third of the set and it's played here by Rob McKillop. Rob McKillop on the 18th century guitar playing that divertimento by James Oswald. By the time Oswald had published those pieces, he was enjoying the company of the English upper classes. He was a member of a secret society of composers, the Temple of Apollo, making friends with people such as John Robinson Lytton, the owner of Nebworth House in Hertfordshire. He also managed to work his way into the Royal Circle to become the official chamber composer to King George III. Oswald's great talent, though, was as a miniaturist with a flair for melody. And it's this that's so well demonstrated in his Airs for the Seasons, the marathon collection of 96 sonatas that he produced between 1755 and 1761. Almost certainly his greatest hits, the pieces were arranged into 48 little suites for the seasons of the year, each bearing the title of an appropriate flower. They were published 12 at a time in four volumes as Airs for the Spring, Airs for the Summer, the Autumn and Winter. And again, with an eye on accessibility and attractiveness, each entire suite was designed to fit onto one sheet of paper. Most of them seem to have been written for the violin, cello and harpsichord, although the picture on the front cover shows a variety of instruments, including the lute, flute and bassoon. That may just have been the designer's fancy, of course, but as always, with an eye on the market, it's likely Oswald wanted to encourage his buyers to play them on any instrument available so that they had the broadest possible appeal. We're going to hear four of them now, performed by the Broadside Band. One flower from each of the seasons. The myrtle for the summer, the nightshade for the autumn, and finally winter's hawthorn. But to start, the narcissus for the spring, which, as you'll hear in the first movement, features quite a bit of imitation between the flute and the cello, perhaps as if Narcissus is looking at his own reflection.
Thank you.
Broadside Band played those four airs for the seasons by James Oswald, ending there with his representation of the Hawthorn. So Oswald's was a real rags-to-riches story, from Scottish fishing village to royal household. And his private life was just as successful. He'd been widowed in the mid-1750s, leaving him in charge of a large family of young daughters. And when his friend John Robinson Lytton died, Oswald married his widow, Leonora, which meant that he spent the rest of his days as Lord of the Manor in the lavish comfort of Nebworth House. The son of a town drummer in Fife had come a long way. Perhaps he'll best be remembered, though, for the way he Italianised traditional Scottish tunes, making them so popular in England in the mid-18th century. Gorgeous old Scots melodies like this, which ends today's programme, Hamilton House.
Hamilton House by James Oswald, played there by Concerto Caledonia. And it ends today's early music show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt. Well, on next Saturday's programme, Lucy will be back to present highlights from this summer's Early Music Days Festival in Regensburg. Do tune in for that if you can at the usual time, just after the 1 o'clock news on Saturday. And don't forget the weekly Early Music Show podcast. Full details are on the Radio 3 website. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 2 o'clock and time now for our Sunday concert, recorded recently at the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester. It's presented by Stuart Flinders.
We've music to lift the spirits by two composers of sacred music. Bruckner's Sixth Symphony may not be overtly devotional, but it comes from a man steeped in the musical language of religion, an organist and devout Catholic. That'll end our concert today. To begin, music by someone else who was equally at home in the organ loft, J.S. Bach, his Christmas oratorio, which offers a more direct spiritual message. The BBC Philharmonic and its chief conductor, Juanjo Mena, will be joined by the Manchester Chamber Choir and three world-class soloists, mezzo Susan Bickley, tenor Nicholas Mulroy, and bass Peter Harvey. Earlier today, I asked Juanjo Mena why he'd chosen to put together this combination of Bach and Bruckner.
The question is wrong, I think. Why not Bach and Bruckner? I think it's a lot of relations in these both composers. It's a lot of similar lines in the composition, similar sonorities. And I think it's so important for us to work in these two directions, in one new style for orchestra, that is the Baroque style, and also our normal and romantic program with Bruckner. If we think about these both composers, is more relation than we can now imagine. No? Two religious men, one Protestant with wife and a lot of children, another one Catholic without no children and no wife, and another conception about the life.
Juanjo Mena talking after today's rehearsal. Well, as cantor of Thomas Schuler in Leipzig, it was Bach's job to write music for services at four city churches. All of this on top of his teaching duties and providing compositions for big civic occasions. For his first few years there, he was writing a new cantata almost every week. Who can blame him for recycling some of them? Much of the music in the Christmas oratorio had already had an outing elsewhere, but it's more than a collection of greatest hits. It's a new unified work with a story, The Birth of Christ. It unfolds in six parts, but it wasn't intended to be heard at a single sitting. Part one, which we'll hear now, would have been sung on Christmas Day itself. The remaining parts would be performed on other days of the season, ending at Epiphany. The story is taken from St. Luke's Gospel and is narrated by a solo tenor. That's Nicholas Mulroy's role tonight. After a triumphant chorus, he takes us from Joseph and Mary's journey to Bethlehem right up to the birth of Jesus. The cantata ends with a gentle celebratory chorale. Ach, mein herzliebes Jesulein. Ah, my heart's beloved little Jesus. Here comes Juanjo Mena and the soloists Susan Bickley, Nicholas Mulroy and Peter Harvey. The BBC Philharmonic and the Manchester Chamber Choir perform part one of Bach's Christmas Oratorio.